sailing home. Slow here.
This is Bird's Eye View, your sailing podcast. Live, Sail, Die have put together what we hope is going to be the most informative and entertaining sailing podcast you have ever heard. I'm Darcy Watergrave. I'm hosting and trying to keep these two roustabouts calmed down. Joey Allen, Barbara Kendall, two of the biggest names in New Zealand sailing. We'll be broadcasting from the Royal New Zealand Yacht Squadron's Crow's Nest, one of the iconic rooms in New Zealand sailing. Lock yourself in. This is going to be fun.
Bird's Eye View is sponsored by Andu, New Zealand's home of feel-good living. With free next-day delivery and price match guarantee, feel good about your appliances and furniture with Andu.
Hi there. Welcome back in again. I'm Darcy Watergrave, courtesy of Live, Sail or Die. You are experiencing Bird's Eye View. We are sitting in the Crow's Nest. When I say we, I mean my little crew of Joey Allen. He's a good boy, Joey Allen. Barbara Kendall and Harold Bennett has been roped into this mess as well. We're going to talk about Harold's extensive life, his involvement in sailing, specifically around dealing with families, dealing with being the parent of a sailor. And I look at you guys like that because you've had that experience. My little girl refuses to have anything to do with sport and she won't listen to me anyway, so I'm not going to go along there as well. Hey, welcome into the podcast, Harold. Great to have you on board.
Thanks, Darcy. It's a pleasure to be here, and maybe we'll uncover a little bit about you people, parents.
And, it's meant to be all about you, Harold, though.
Oh, well. Okay.
We're going to be twisting it back.
You're attired correctly as well. It's a good old school jersey you've got running there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, nice. Representing from the start. Hey, look, let's start things off with a bit of chaos. The biggest bit of chaos you've been involved in. You'll keenly remember the time where a rather valuable trophy got smashed into tiny pieces by some roaming rebel. Do you remember the America's Cup destruction quite carefully?
I do. And it was down in that members' lounge, which is below here, and we were setting up to, I think, run a national match racing championship. And myself and Mary Grant, another member of our squadron team, we were there setting out the tape papers and clothing and things of all those sort of natures. And then bursting through the door came this guy. And
When you say bursting, what?
He was running.
He was running, right? He was going for it, right?
He ran in and he's swinging the sledgehammer around. And next thing, it goes straight through into the glass, which didn't break, obviously, straight off. And so he gave it a pretty good thumping. And all within a couple of seconds, this has happened. And my initial reaction was for Mary. She freaked out. And I got her out of there. And I go back, and by then he's finished. And I thought to myself, I wonder if I should have tackled that guy or whether I should have just done what I did. And then I thought, you know, he's a lot younger than you and he's swinging a sledgehammer around, so maybe I'm better not there.
What did you do, though? What was it? Did you freeze?
Well, no, I just turned around and got Mary and got her out of there.
Right.
And then when I get back to it, he's pretty much over and done with, and he just sat down, put the hammer down, sat on the floor.
You never argue with a hammer, mate.
No, I tell you what, no way. It's bad enough hitting your thumb.
Was his hands in his head when he was sitting down, just going, "Oh no, what did I just do?" Or was he like sitting there and sort of stunned?
No, he just sat there as if nothing had happened.
Wow.
And it was only minutes later the police were here, and they just walked up the stairs and he stood up and they took him away, and it was that easy.
So targeted, he plainly knew where he was going. So he must have scoped the place. He must have been there before. Did anyone recognise him or see? I'm just working out how he know where he was going.
I don't think at that point we had anyone who was like the concierge down there waiting to find out who's coming through. But because I guess the squadron at that time thought that because we had this thing in a nice secure case, that it was probably pretty safe. But we soon found out that, no, a sledgehammer and even that shatterproof glass, or what do they call it, some super tough glass, it does break. And he eventually got to it. But it was all over in matters of seconds, 20 seconds probably, and it's all done.
Wow.
What happens when you see it all mashed to pieces like it was? Did you go and inspect it? Did you have a wee look at it?
Well, I had a look at it and then I thought, well, yeah, it's going to take a little bit to fix, and which it did. And it was a way for I don't know, 9 months or 6 months or something, and came back better than new and with another bit on the bottom, I think. And so it was, in a way, maybe you did us a favour, I don't know.
Security-wise, what picked up from there? Because plainly that's a shot across the bow, excuse the pun.
Well, after that, I mean, the I think it was a German company had offered to put that casing in that's down there now that, if you go in there and touch that thing will come down and jam your fingers. So, well, it used to. We'd seen it tested, and it certainly, you know, if someone went and thumped the glass, then bang, that thing came down and covered the whole thing up so you couldn't even see it. And that was, you know, it was steel then. So it was, you know, there was security was taken pretty seriously after that. And there was usually always a concierge down there.
Joey, you need to go and test that security for us. Just stick your fingers in, you'll be fine, mate. They're tough old fingers. They've been crunched before, haven't they?
You're bringing back some great memories. We were sitting waiting to get pulled out of the water on NZL, it would have been NZL 32, and we were parked side toe out here waiting for the Hikanui, or I can't remember the name of the crane. Oh, yeah. But they used to lift us out of the water and put us on the naval base. And we're sitting there, and a chase boat came out. And I remember the guy, he was his face was pale. And he said, guys, I've got really, really bad news. And you immediately think Harold Bennett's died or something serious has happened, you know, something really serious when you hear that sentence. And he said, the America's Cup's just been smashed in the squadron. And we all started laughing. The whole crew... bar one guy started laughing. We thought it was hilarious. But Richard Dodson was the only guy that he was angry with all of us, and he stood up and gave us a good toweling down. Mm. Guys, that's our cup, and we never thought of it as our cup. We'd only owned it for a few months. Mm. But to Richard, it was his. That was our trophy, and he took it in a completely different way than the rest of us. So we... Yeah, it was a big argument broke out, and Richard Dodson won the argument.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, you're looking after it, aren't you? The cup's been given to you, and you pass it on, so you kind of have to leave it in reasonably
good
state.
Yeah, but to be honest, like when we picked it up in San Diego, Russell and Kevin Shoebridge didn't treat it that well either that night. It got a bit of a ding in it. And, the less said about that, the
better. You're looking a bit defensive there, those arms folded, mate. What did you do?
Yeah. When you get guys like Andrew Taylor and Craig Monk, you know, having a good swig of alcohol before we picked it up, things are always going to go bad, you know.
Anyway, now is it looked after, you know, in previous cups now? Is that everyone revered them, looked after it like it should have been?
Oh, I think the...
Or has it had some good... Seen some good
I think it's had a fair amount of... how do you put it? Activity that shouldn't have happened with it. I think you'd want to talk to some of the guys off Oracle when they won, where that cup went that night.
Yeah, let's not talk about
it. I don't think we should go down that road, but it's had some experiences.
It holds a lot of stories.
Oh, if it would only speak.
Yeah.
I mean, some of those stories would be fantastic.
It holds quite a lot of lubricant as well.
Nothing. There's a big bolt in the top.
Hopeless.
So you wouldn't want it at your 21st or anything?
No. I don't even remember those days. Harold Bennett is our guest. Bird's Eye View. This is courtesy of the wonderful folk at Live Sail Darcy Waldegrave. Harold, we should go back to the start of your career. Not that far back, because I know you'd struggle to remember there as well. But you've had a long, illustrious history being involved with sailing in New Zealand. What stood out the most for you when you look back at what you've done? Because you've covered so many different areas in sailing. What's your legacy? What are you most proud of?
That's hard to say, really, because there's been so many real good experiences from right the beginning. And I always remember when I was I did part-time coaching for what was the Yachting Federation in those days. And I remember going to there was an Auckland one I had to do one weekend, and it was out at... Pamua Basin, and there was a young blonde girl here that was to get on a boat, and her dad said to me, who was well known in the yachting circles in Auckland and New Zealand. He said to me, you got a bit on there because she doesn't want to do it. And I said, oh, she'll be fine, I think. And anyhow, Barbara got in the boat and got out and did a bit of sailing over that weekend. And then ever since that, every time Tony has seen me, he would say, you know what, you're responsible for that. And I, well, no, I'm not responsible for it, Tony. Yes, you are. You got her to go out and sail that day. And I said, well, fine. She's done well.
So how early was that, sorry, Barbara? When?
Oh, I would have been 12, 13, something like that. So it was. I started when I was about 12.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty little thing.
But then it went on, you know. I mean, you did the peak class through.
She went okay.
It was okay.
She went okay, yeah.
It was okay. Yeah. Let's not talk about me, though. Let's talk about you. What were some of the other ones, you know, with your sailing and your, you know, what stood out?
Well, I think the coaching was pretty dear to me because in Murray's Bay, I was still competitively sailing OKs. But Murray's Bay had a lot of good P-class sailors there. And I was helping out with the late Clive Roberts with a coaching session down at Takapuna for a whole youth team, group of youths. And on one of these days, it was blowing like mad. So the game was, we're going to play soccer on the beach. Well, that's sort of one of the stupid things. I'd never be doing that again. But I'd stood on the ball, fell over, did something bad in my knee, and I could not hike off an OK then. So I went to the club and I just said, well, I'd be happy to coach these kids and see how we get on. And the kids were great. We did a lot of sailing. Did a lot of develop some techniques for them to learn and things like that. And the end result of that was that we won a nationals that year. And I thought, that's not bad.
So that was the light bulb moment.
Well,
it
was.
I can actually do this.
Yeah, you can.
Because, yeah.
I mean, you looked at coaching sailing and everyone said, sailing doesn't have coaches, Christ. I mean, coaches are for rugby and soccer and all the other sports, but you don't coach in sailing. I mean, you don't do it.
So you didn't have anything to work through. Sorry to interrupt, but you had no template, essentially. You had to start from scratch and build how actually a coach worked.
Absolutely. It was a blank sheet of paper.
That's pretty awesome, really, when you think about it now, because, you know, you think about even when I was, we didn't have coaches at all, really. We had people that sort of organised the racing, but no one sort of telling you what to do. We got that coaching every now and then. And you look at it now, it's a totally different game, you know, totally different game. But, yeah, so you were the inaugural coacher.
Well, it seems that, yeah, well, apparently that's the story. But I think that out of that, and I always remember Alan Coutts, Russell's father, who he came up to a nationals with Russell when Russell was small. And he saw what we'd done there because we'd won the Tauranga Cup and the Tanner Cup for Murray's Bay. And Alan said to me, I think we better get you down to Dunedin and teach the boys a bit down there. I'll get you a ticket. And so that was the first of the travelling sort of thing. And once I'd done that, the Federation at that point had actually taken notice of what was going on because we had kids go to the World Youth Championships. Clive had taken a team away before, and then I took a team away. And then they said, well, you know, would you work part-time? And I thought, yeah, that'd be all right, do a little bit of coaching.
What was your job outside of that?
I was working in structural steel.
Okay.
Buildings, you know, steel buildings. So I was running a workshop on the North Shore and doing this on part-time. And so getting around the country and you know, I went down to Dunedin with Russell's dad and we started things there. And then Alan became the chairman of the youth committee for Federation then. And so he was very helpful in making sure that we were able to get to the places and everyone seemed to get something out of it wherever I went. And so it was enjoyable because, one, we were seeing kids in their own areas and then encouraging those kids to get out. And to the various sailmakers around that time, there was, I guess, there was Lydgards, there was Hoods, there was sails and canvas on the North Shore, there was Barry Toms. Toms were doing it.
Yeah, Giddens.
Giddens, yes. I think all those guys were doing P-class sails. So lo and behold, I've got a large bag with a whole lot of different P-class sails in. Threw them out on the ground when you went to one of these venues and said, guys, these are, try them, see what you think. It might help you get a new sail one day, you know, you might like one of these. And so that was a beginning of things to sort of get the information that was probably more within Auckland, out of Auckland and around the country. And that worked to a large degree.
What were the pathways like back then for young sailors? Did they actually have direction? Did they know what they were doing or where it may end up? Or was it purely just, let's learn how to do this for the love of doing it? We'll see what happens beyond that.
Well, during that time that I was working part-time there, the youth committee, they actually came up with the traditional pathway, which was like a P-class, then a Starling, and then double hander, whatever that was. I think we were jumping almost from P-class to 470 days.
We were.
And laser, because the youth trials and the youth worlds at those in that period were all in full laser and 470s.
Yeah,
or 470 here, but 420 overseas.
It was 420s. We didn't have 420s in the country.
No, we didn't then.
No.
But so there was, you know, we were making a lot of progress and that pathway started then. And since then, that's been modified in many ways and with all the different classes there now. And certainly the way that our sport is developing into the high speed classes and Barbara's favourite one, of course. And I won't mention it. And so, you know, how things are still moving on. And I think we're getting places, and we punch above our weight in this country. We really do.
Hey, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Changing the subject, Harold, can you tell us either one or two stories of Russell Coutts's worst situations that you've seen on the racing course?
Can he? I think so.
There's a fair amount of them. I think what the
you don't have to look too far, Harold.
The first one was a real beaut, in his first match racing event. Were you with him?
No, I was there, but
oh, okay. But he decides to he's going to start on port, and the boat that was above him was on starboard. Obviously, I'm going to duck it, so he ducked it. But lo and behold, there was the bow of Te Tai Nui, I think the boat was, big wooden catch that he ploughed straight into. And
Carvel boat, right? Carvel.
Yeah, yeah. And so the word went out, stop everything, we've got to get this boat up on the slip. And so that was that was there.
It. Did he hold it?
Oh, yeah, he nailed it. And so that put, we had to get another boat out there to as a start boat. That was quite an embarrassing one for Russell. And one of his other ones was out here. We got the backstay caught on the overhang.
It's called the Harbour Bridge.
Yeah. That's it. That thing.
It's been there a while.
I know. And he knew that. Mm. But he managed to do, he can do all sorts of silly things.
What about the one, what about the one in San Francisco?
Oh, yes. No, that was a good one. We're at the start, and obviously we're boats are starting across the breeze, and I'm standing on the line watching. We're all automatic, but I'm still doing the manual thing if things go down. So I'm watching my line, and the big fella Ian Murray standing next to me, and he nudges me, and he goes, "Hey, have a look at this," and I look to my left, and well, there was Russell up there, and I said, "No, he won't try that." And so the countdown's going, get the 30 seconds, and he goes, "Have another look." I looked and I thought, "Oh no, he better not be." And then so now we're concentrating on what we're doing, and then it gets 5, 4, 3, crash, straight into the side of our signal boat, which was a big boat, and he left part of the bow in that boat. It actually hit the side of the boat at a bulkhead, which was a sandwich. The bulkhead was sandwich. And his bow had actually hit that right in the middle, and it went in and inside. And, of course, it snapped off. And we've still got that. That will appear somewhere someday, yeah. Believe me.
I mean, they're good for him never to forget that.
Oh, it'll come up. It'll come up.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But I'll never forget that day because Alistair McCrae, who was our skipper, he immediately, he looks down and he goes, holy hell, there's blood everywhere. And I thought, blood everywhere? Couldn't be blood everywhere. Anyhow, we had a lot of guests on board that day, and, of course, they were all standing on the side where he hit, and they were, because they were in their nice red wines and things like that, so they all ducked. And the prod goes straight across the boat, you know, on over the gunwales, and they all fall on the ground. There's red wine everywhere, so poor old Alistair thought he had blood. Injuries. Oh. And the next word I hear is Russell's calling out to the bow, are we ready to go? The rig's flopping around and everything's broken. And I think it was Simon Daubney had yelled to him, Russell, we're not going anywhere. And
we're going back to the dock.
We're going to the dock. So that was a good one.
Your time in coaching, that's not necessarily dealing with L'Enfant Terrible or someone like that, but what about your relationship with the children, their relationship with their parents? Because getting kids into sailing, and I suppose from a parent's point of view, and I look at sailing parents, to keep their hands off what's going on. Well, what are the good things to do if you're getting your kid into sailing? What are the must-dos and what are the must-don'ts? More's the point. You would have experienced, I don't know how much of this, but you'd be pretty rich in this.
Yeah, there's been some interesting experiences with parents. But first and foremost, the parents are an essential part of that whole project because they've got to support them. They've got to get them to the venue. They've got to get them their boat. They've got to fund it.
Thank you.
They've got to do all of those things. And so they are so important. And I always maintain that throughout this country, we probably see some of the best sailors and most natural sailors sitting on the beach because they can't afford to go out. And they can't afford a boat. And I'm no doubt that happens. And we see natural kids just appear. Parents leave them alone and bang, they're off. So first and foremost, that support has got to be there. Otherwise they won't achieve anything. So my belief is that if a parent, and now it's changed a little now that we've got a lot of coaches out there working where you can link up with a coach and say, you know, or in a club, they've got a club coach working with the kids. Leave them to it. They are the guys that know what they're doing. And just let them be. Go and watch occasionally. Be there when they come back. But let the coaches deal with the job.
But what happens if you've got coaches that have really experienced because they've gone through the system? So they're world-class coaches, and now their kids are coming through, and they've got coaches coaching them. And you know that the coaches aren't doing their good job, and you're like, well, how do you tune in? What do you do with those parents? Because there's quite a few of those ones as well that have been sailors, pretty good in their own right, but they yes.
I think one of the interesting things that's happened in that vein is in the years gone by when we've been running clinics like Junior Sail with Optimist and down in Taupo and places like that, these kids now are parents with their kids. And some of those guys that they've appeared and I look at them and just say to them, I'm watching you. And they do get embarrassed because they know, and these are particular guys that I had singled out that had an experience with their parents, you know. I just look at them and say, I'm watching you. We know. So there's a bit of I think from those particular people, when if I start talking to them about it, you know, they really backpedal and go, yeah, well, I'm doing my best here, you know. And But, yeah, it's hard not to. I know it's hard not to. But, you know, and you can be a coach for your kid if you like. But there's a way of dealing with that too.
Dare I say, is there a sense of entitlement to a degree? I'm peeling off a lot of money for this. I've done that experience before without me, the kid going. Do you have to fight that much at all, or is that?
Oh, look, I think that's a problem that we see right across the board right now, is that, and we've been seeing it in The Optimist with the kids that are being pushed and pushed and pushed so hard because the money's being spent and they're sailing in the Nationals for one of 25 places to go offshore to a major event. And I'm going, blimey, that's a...
intense for it.
That's pretty intense.
10-year-old, yeah.
Well, does it take the joy out of it? And I think the essence in all sport that I've been involved in is joy. Without that, well, what is the point in doing it? And that pressure can crush people.
Well, it can. And I've seen it crush sailors. I've seen it.
They burn out really fast.
I think the Optimist was struggling with that for a long period of time because they had their association was probably made up of people who were hell-bent on making sure their kids got to the Worlds or major events somewhere. And what I did see in the last Nationals, which was down at Queen Charlotte, I saw a totally different attitude within the parents and the kids. There was a lot more smiling faces at that event than I'd seen at a previous Nationals.
Why?
Because the parents seem to have a different attitude towards what they're there for. And they've got a committee which is different. And that committee seems to have turned some of the, what I call, tough stuff around, such as the these ranking regattas. They've culled some of those out. And that the Green Fleet won't race for points now. They don't have to race for points. They go fun and enjoyment, you know, enjoy, make the skills work, get the coaches there helping them. And they're a different sort of coach to the coach that you're taking to sail in an event
in
with.
In a race, yeah.
So they're a different race coach. They're not a race coach. They're a development coach, if you like to put it that way. So there's different tiers of that now, which you've got to pick your way through that. And as a parent, I guess it's pretty hard. Yes, you want to see your kid do well. So who's the most likely thing? Well, I want to win. So I'll go and get Barbara Kendall to coach my kid, you know, or whoever it might be. And you go, well, why do you want to do that? You know, is that going to work? Well, we've got to get there. We spend so much money on this kid that we've got to deal with it. So that's the bit that I've really found difficult in my mind to get past. But I've seen a slight change in that, and I think it's good for the future of some of these kids, and we're seeing it that way in the skiffs.
Yeah.
That go to the Skiff Nationals. That is just like the greatest fun event you'd ever get involved in.
And that, you know, the kids, well, it just happened to be at Manly this year, and the smiles of the kids and the excitement. It did help that they had really good breeze, and so they're all just frothing. You know, going around the top mark and sending it downwind, and you ask them, you know, what's your favourite thing? Oh, just sending it downwind, you know. So it wasn't, and none of them talked about where they placed in that race. I mean, the winners are still going to win because they're naturally competitive, but you know, you've got a sailing's for all, so it's making it fun and doing it with their mates. And the amount of girls that were in the skiff, which was really awesome for me,
huge number of girls,
yeah,
that's really neat to see.
What's your experience coaching? As a dad.
Yeah, come on, Joe.
Were you one of the guys on the sidelines screaming and yelling?
Look, I think back to my day when we were learning. I sailed with Earl Williams. We grew up little boys sailing flying ants. And our dads were yachties, but they were yachting. They were out sailing. And in those days, they'd do a 90-miler every weekend. And so you wouldn't see your dad all weekend. So our mums were our coaches. And we were the slowest learning. we were so far behind all the North Shore boys just because of that, you know. We were the worst coached two boys on the planet. And then I became a dad and had a son and forced him into the Opti. And the boy, never said much, but he didn't really want to be there. He didn't really want to do it. But I was the stereotypical opti dad that forced him into it. And he ended up in a very good group with the top kids from Wakatere. And it was about a year later we realised his eyesight was terrible. So I basically put the boy off yachting forever. And you know, I love my son, but he just came to me, just pleaded with me, "Dad, it's just not for me," you know. And I just look back and I just wish I could do that all over again. You know, I got it very, very wrong. But I can remember him sitting in Russell Coutts' lounge with Russell, telling what he can do better, and this little boy looking up at God and going, I'd rather be in the skateboard park, you know, I'd rather be surfing.
So what's your key lesson around this? If you want to encourage your child into doing this, they're not interested. Do you let it go?
The mistake I made is I just didn't listen.
Yeah.
I didn't listen. The signs were all there. But my arrogant, stupid little brain just keep forcing it. You want your kid to be a sailor.
Yeah, I've had a slightly different experience. So, you know, my girls followed me around the world when I was competing still. So they're brought up in and around beaches and on windsurfers. And then when my oldest was about 10, I said, okay, well, you know, I've got to teach you how to windsurf. So she was probably about 13 at the time. And so I took her down to Lake Pupuki and I gave her a lesson on the, and sent her off on the board. And she sailed upwind, went around a mark and came back. And I went, oh my God. She looked at me and she says, "Mum, I know I'm quite good. I've just been watching you and stuff, but I don't want to race. So don't even ask me that to do that ever again. I don't want to be like you." And so that was it. That was her done. And
but you listened.
Yeah, I did. I didn't. Yeah, I did. Females, they tend to listen a little bit more because you're mums, you know. And then, sorry to put the knife in there, Joey, but that's kind of what happened. And then my second one, my youngest one, she came around and it was just when the Russell Coutts Sailing Foundation was having up at Manly. Because there was no way I was going to put them both into Optimus because they've been surfing and they've been windsurfing and they've been doing these extreme sports and they're just sitting in an Optimus and that wasn't their thing. Mm. So when the skiff was around, I put Amy and she was 12 at the time. And I said, "Well, you know, it's my right. I've got to teach you how to sail. You know, you've got to learn how to sail because that's the thing. So do it for one term, and if you don't like it, you can quit." So didn't tell her how to do it. She went in and she was really, really nervous because, oh my God, Barbara Kendall's her mother. And luckily, Russell's son was there as well. So, you know, she wasn't by herself with a famous sailing parent. Anyway, she went sailing and she came in at the end of the day and I wasn't anywhere near to be seen. And I said, "How did it go, Amy?" And she goes, "Oh, I got the record." I said, "What'd you get the record for?" "For the most amount of can outs, 24, Mum." I had no idea what I was doing. I was so bad. And I went, "Yes, you got the record. That is fantastic. Do you want to go back next week?" "Yep." Because I just figured out that's the thing I was most scared of was falling out of the boat and looking stupid. And I fell out of the boat and I looked stupid. And now it's done with it. I'm just going to go back and learn how to sail.
But that lesson there, like dealing with learning about fear, you see it in every young person stepping into an opti or a bic. You see that. And the joy they get when they've conquered the fear of...
Absolutely.
It's basically they're driving a car.
Yeah.
They are responsible for hitting a rock or...
Yep, and hitting it in another boat.
Correct.
At speed.
But Russell, you see that joy in there. You must thrive off that.
That's the love of it. And then watching them evolve and then I said, then I had to bribe her. So then it was bribery. I said, "Well, you know, if you keep sailing another term, we'll buy you, instead of a surfing suit, you can have a sailing suit, you know, a wetsuit." And then, so then we got the next term, and then the Worlds were going to be in Manly. I thought, right, well, if you keep going, we'll buy your own boat instead of using the club's boats, because you don't want to invest in your kid unless they're into it. And so we got her own boat. She did the Worlds, and every day she cried after the racing. But every day she picked herself up and went out sailing because she'd been sailing two terms, you know, five months, and we put her into the world champs.
So, Harold, you would have seen a lot of this throughout your time, throughout the many years you've been involved in coaching. Mm. The worst displays that you look and go, "Wow, what are you doing?"
Well, let me give you my experience as a parent as well. Oh. And when... our eldest daughter, she wasn't interested in sailing at all. And when our son came along, and it was like, right, P class. He's got to have a P class. So I got him a P class. And And at this time, I was doing this. I started this part-time coaching around the country by then. And anyhow, he had this boat for about 6 months, I suppose. And I was off with a youth team overseas. I come home, when I get home, 3 weeks later or whatever it was, we drive up the drive and I look, there's no P-class. And I said to Robin, where's the boat? That's another story. We'll show you when you get inside. Well, I go into his bedroom. He's got a guitar and an amplifier. That guy today is the best sound engineer in this country and does sound for all the major bands, international
where's
bands.
Where's the P-class?
Went, disappeared.
Sold
he sold it.
Sold it and put a guitar in an amp.
Bought the guitar.
When Dad was back. That is awesome.
And then after that, it was Carla came along, so we got an optimist, and she was fearsome in that thing. And she just had to win at all costs, you know, and it was like, oh, I'm not sure about dealing with this one. And anyhow, the story went on about that kids used to start teasing her that, hey, you're lucky, your dad's the coach, you know, you get all the tips. And she turned on them and just said, you've no idea. He's never even here any time I go racing. Never here. I was out coaching other kids. Mm-hmm. So that left her to it. She's still competitively sales today, which is great.
I suppose not being there is better than being there and being dominant or shouting. What was the thing you avoid the most? What do you look at?
Well, I think you've got to avoid the confrontation and certainly look for the signs. And, you know, Joey, you mentioned that, you know, the signs were there, but you never saw them. I'm looking for those signs at any time when we're around an event or coaching clinics or something like that. I'm looking at I'm watching kids. I'm looking at their eyes. I'm looking at...
How long did it take you to learn those skills?
That came over a long period of time.
Takes a long time, huh?
Yeah. It does. And
again, I think females have that straight away, just putting it out there. I mean, you know your kids and you read your kids. This is where the females are so important in yachting, as we've talked about before. It's taken a really long time. No, it's true.
I feel I'm being bullied.
All being bullied.
I'm actually standing up a little bit because it's, you know, it is a male-dominated frigging sport. You know, it is. And it's really hard for females to get a step in. But as a female mum, as a mum sailing coach, you know, you are so in tune with your kids. You know when to pull back. You know when to give information because you're just reading because it's intuition. You know, it's emotional intelligence. And you just know. And it's been, you know, my daughter now has competed for in the Youth World Champs a couple of times. And I was the coach in the last one and was coaching her all last year. And it's a really fine line between when you're a coach and you're a mum and having those boundaries in place so you're doing it in an intelligent way so you're actually bringing out the best in them and not forcing information into them and letting them take their journey. And the hardest thing is when you're watching them and you know that they're going to choke, you know that they're going to have a really bad race or a bad regatta, and you can see it happening and there's nothing you can do about it, and you have to sit back and go, yep, go and choke, and it's exactly what happened. And then you pick them up afterwards, and then when they come back fighting from that choke, that's the reward. That to me is like an amazing reward, because you've got to allow them to fail so they learn how to win.
So Harold, I keep elbowing on this, so I'm going to get it out of you eventually. I got told I'm going to have to beat some ounces out of you by a couple of people, and I was doing some research around your attitude. Go on, tell us the worst display you've seen in parenting, whatever class, it doesn't matter. One you've just gone, oh, wow.
Well, I'll tell you, I saw one recently at the Optimist Nationals, believe it or not. Even though I did say before that whole thing was different. It was in the Green Fleet. And there was a parent who had a son in the Green Fleet who was laying marks. But he got so involved in what his kid was doing, he absolutely trashed the coach that was there to the point where another coach had come up and said, hey, this guy's... this is off the planet, you know. And so he just continued abusing both kid and coach on the water.
Wow.
And it was, I thought to myself, boy, that's got to be taken further, which it has been. And I don't know what they've done, but it wouldn't have ended well.
It wasn't Dean Barker, was it?
No, it wasn't Dean Barker.
thank God for that.
No, Dino was very good. He came and asked questions very politely and I give him the right answers. You know.
So that'd be a better demonstration of what a parent should do, the best example of that. When you sit there and go, you've got it, you've dialed into this, that's the key thing.
Well, one of the best experiences I had out of that was going back right in the early days of the P-class coaching at Murray's Bay. And there was a young boy there. His parents were English. He was a bundle of nerves the whole time. He had to rig the boat. He'd never been a sailor in his life, but he had to rig the boat, and the boat was an absolute dog. But I could see the boy was trying hard, and he did all the things that you wanted to see a kid do in the boat. And I'm thinking, there's a talent there, but we've got to get it out of him. And his father came to me one day and he said, I've got to get him a better boat, and then I can coach him into winning this championship that's going to be at Murray's Bay. And I said, well, that's not going to work the way you're operating. And I said, you're going to have to listen to me. And so I said to him, the best thing you can do is let me find him a boat. I'll get a good boat. And then the other best thing that can happen is that you go away, you put the boat down on the beach, go away somewhere, and don't come down here and leave it to what we're doing. Leave it to me. He looked at me. He looked at me. No, it was going down like a bowl of sick.
Yeah.
And so I thought, no, I'm going to stand my ground because this guy has got some talent. And I looked around, and Chris had won the Tarrant Cup the year before with a boat that we'd found, a good boat that we'd found for him. And so we got that boat for this kid, put him in it, and he started to develop very quickly and well. And I said to his father, I said, the Nationals is coming up. I want to see you gone from day one. And he said, look, I've got the message. We're going to go away and we'll come back after the regatta. I said, perfect. So this young fella, he goes out, Brent was his name, he goes out, wins the Tanner Cup, and I think he was second in the Tauranga Cup. He couldn't have been a happier kid. And he said, you know, that was awesome getting Dad out of the way, because he just used to drive me nuts, just telling me what I should be doing, what side of the course I should be on. And he knows nothing about sailing. And when that guy came back, the first thing he did is he came down and I got a bottle of whiskey. So that was worth it. He accepted that.
The whiskey
that.
Was definitely worth it.
It was, yeah, absolutely. It was worth it.
It's all about the whiskey.
But the thing was, he recognised what he was being told and he did back off. And so that, to me, that was a very good... That was a very good experience for both the parent, the kid, and myself to have. And then, that's part of the learning curve of things.
But Harold, you are one guy in New Zealand that you've got the respect of everybody. Not, you know, your position gives you the power to be able to deliver those messages. And we should all bow to you because you've got so much respect across the whole of the community. It's amazing.
Oh, well, thanks.
I don't think many people could deliver that message as well.
Well, it's just the way I operate, I guess. And, the interesting part about that, adopting that same principle throughout the America's Cup as a race officer was just as... that sort of changed things, but... The principles were all the same.
What, you treated them all like children, these America's Cup races, is that what you're saying?
Well, when you tell a billionaire that he's not going to get what he wants, and he looks at you and then you think to yourself, did I say the right thing to him? But then you say, well, to hell with it. That's the way it's going to be.
And on that, we're going to walk away. One last thing, Harold Bennett, thank you so much for your time and your tales. Who's going to win the America's Cup this time around? How confident are you that, I won't say it's coming home, because it looks like it's going to stay overseas regardless of who wins it. That's another story for another day, but who wins this?
Well, you'd have to think that the way that this operates now, the America's Cup, that New Zealand is still in the best seat in the house for, you know, to do that. Their development has been there. It's solid, well proven. And the other guys are probably still in catch-up mode for some of that stuff. They're all out there. They're in boats that look sort of similar, and I guess when you're travelling around at that sort of pace, I mean, I guess the worst fear is gear breakage or a capsize or something like that that would put you out of the game. But I think if everything stays upright, I'd say they've got a shoe-in to get it.
I got a funny feeling the longer this podcast goes on, the longer the interviews are going to become. I'd suggest that Harold Bennett's probably worth about 8 series of information on that. Harold, a proper GC, a yachting legend, thanks so much for joining us up here in the Crow's Nest. I'm Darcy Waldegrave, along with Joey Allen and Barbara Kendall, Bird's Eye View, courtesy of Live, Sail and Die. And we'd like to thank the Royal New Zealand Yacht Squadron so much for allowing us to pollute what is a sacred part of real estate when it comes to sailing here in Aotearoa. Hey, you look after each other, and remember, keep your nose out of your children sailing, because guys like this know exactly what they're doing. You go well.